The way the culture looks at Christians is always kind of a bit of a weird thing, isn't it? You know, Christians often are portrayed in quite weird ways, or in just misleading ways. For example, oh, Christians, they're people that think they've got it all together. Or they're people that think they're perfect, or even they're people whose lives are controlled by guilt. There's all these different kind of contradictory ideas, and often quite disparaging, or often viewed quite negatively. But it's interesting, when times get tough, when Christians really start to suffer, people then start to take notice. And you'll hear comments like, how do they have such confidence? How do they have such boldness? Where does their hope come from? And that's what we're thinking about today. We're continuing this series called The Difference. And we're thinking about what is it that is so radically different about true Christianity? What is it that makes somebody bold before God and before the world? Makes somebody transformed from the inside out? What is it that gives somebody who follows Jesus a confidence and a hope, even in the darkest and most difficult situations? And actually, we haven't really said this over the last few weeks, but every week we've been thinking about different aspects of motivation for Christians. The first week in chapter 3, thinking about how amazing what we have in Jesus actually is. If we realized how good it is, we would be just blown away. We would be so stirred by that. And then in chapter 4, there were a couple of sections that we took over the past couple of weeks, looking at some of the things that might discourage us. The fact that people seem so unresponsive to this good news that we have. And actually what Paul, the writer, ends up saying is essentially, it's not difficult, it's impossible. It's beyond your ability to take somebody and bring them together with the message of Jesus and transform their life. Only God can turn on the lights in a human heart. So we don't give up. We don't lose heart. We pray and we present Jesus. And we trust God to bring about change. And then the following week, we looked at the second half of chapter 4. Another great reason why we could be discouraged is that actually we're not as impressed with ourselves as the world might think we are. We know we don't have it all together. We feel like jars of clay, easily cracked, fragile, expendable, just not impressive in any way. And yet, we don't lose heart. Why? Because that maybe is part of God's design. So that the treasure that he puts within us, this transforming reality on the inside of us, the life of God by the Spirit of God inside of us, it's clearly something that isn't us. We're not achieving it. We're not gritting our teeth and kind of clenching our muscles and making ourselves something special. No, we're not special at all. But what God has put inside of us really is. And so we do not lose heart. And now we come to the end of chapter 4. And we're going to read the last few verses of 4 and the first half of chapter 5. And in these three paragraphs, Paul is going to point forward. He's going to point forward to the hope that Christians have. He's going to really get into what it is that motivates Christians to keep going, sometimes under the most difficult of circumstances. Why is it that when Christians struggle, their heart starts to lean toward heaven? What is it about heaven that's so special? I mean, you can't see it. You can't prove it. How can you know it's real? How can you live based on something invisible? Well, Paul is going to talk about that in this next little section that we're looking at. There used to be a saying. I don't think it's a saying anymore, but there's a reason for it. But there used to be a saying, so-and-so is so heavenly-minded, he's of no earthly use. Don't hear that anymore, because maybe none of us are really heavenly-minded like we should be. But actually, the saying is wrong. And Paul's going to show that actually, if we are not heavenly-minded, we are not really very much earthly use. We need that in order to live this. And so over three paragraphs, he's going to explain and he's going to present this aspect of what makes what we have so different. Okay, so let's jump in at 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 16. If you haven't been with us for this series, just mention, this is a document that's been preserved for us. It's a letter The chapters and verses were added later, but originally it's just a letter written by a follower of Jesus called Paul to a church in what we would call Greece, a place called Corinth. And we've kind of jumped in, starting at chapter 3, because in this section, he's explaining what it is that makes Christianity so radically special and different. And so, at the end of chapter 4, starting at verse 16, he says, "So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day." Remember last week we talked about the jars of clay, the treasure's inside, but the outside's not that great. He's still got that image in mind. Our outer self, our jars of clay, are wasting away, but the treasure on the inside is being renewed day by day. And then he says this, verse 17, "For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory, beyond all comparison, as we look not to things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." So he's kind of doing this contrast, right, between what we can see, this life, everything around us, and what we cannot see, the life to come. He's talking about things that are temporary, like us here, and everything, even buildings this old, all temporary in comparison to the eternal long forever that is to come. But maybe the thing that is the hardest to get our heads around is that little combo of words that he puts in there when he talks about this life and he says this light momentary affliction. Hang on a minute. You can't call it that. It's not light, is it? Life in this world is not light, it's heavy. And it's not momentary, frankly, it drags, especially when times are tough, right? Remember when lockdown started back in the day, 3 weeks to flatten the curve? 16 months, maybe, not before then. It's a frustrating situation, isn't it, to be in something and it just feels heavy, it feels long, it feels like it's dragging, and this is nothing compared to what many people go through. What do you do when you are suffering with something physical? It could be something like insomnia or migraines or chronic fatigue. It could be blindness. It could be cancer. It could be diabetes. Whatever it is, it's not light, is it? Anything like that feels really heavy. And generally, these things are not momentary. They can really, really drag on. Long, difficult, worry-filled days, even longer, dark, lonely nights. Physical suffering is not a light and a momentary thing. What about relational struggles? Maybe you're in a marriage that is just broken. And you're sustaining it for the sake of somebody out there somewhere, maybe the children, maybe someone else, but you know, it's just deeply broken, and there's no connection, and it hurts. And that is not light, and it's certainly not momentary. That seems to go on and on and on. Or maybe you're longing to be married, and it just feels like it's a never-ending trudge. The challenge of parenting. The challenge of financial difficulty or a spiral debt and a hole that you don't feel like you can ever climb out of. We could just go on and on, couldn't we? There's so many things in this world that don't feel light and don't feel momentary. They feel heavy, they feel like they're forever, and they're hard just to keep going through. And so who's Paul, the writer of this document, to call this light and momentary? If you're a teenager, please don't get offended by this, but I hope you understand what I mean by this. If Paul is a teenager whose only ever suffering was to break a guitar string, right, then we wouldn't take it from him, would we? You know, like, oh yeah, man, once it was really hard, like, you know, the D just totally snapped. okay, you've got no idea, mate. Right? If somebody is kind of coming from a really cushy life and everything's been easy, it's very easy to say, oh, come on, people, things aren't so tough. You go, well, no, maybe not for you, but look around you. The rest of the world is struggling. Is that Paul? Is Paul, you know, a guy with a broken string on his guitar who's kind of struggling and thinks that's as bad as it gets? No, it's not. In fact, let me read you just a few verses from later in the book where Paul, we're not going to look at this in detail, but Paul is kind of describing some of what he's experienced. And this is an amazing, amazing list of things that he's gone through. Let me see, where shall I jump in? He talks about far greater labors. People are kind of comparing himself to him, saying he hasn't experienced much. And he goes, well, okay, how about this? Far greater labors, far more imprisonments, countless beatings, often near death. He says, 5 times I received at the hands of the Jews the 40 lashes less one. 5 times. When Paul wrote this, he had scars on his back where the skin had been ripped apart. 5 times. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. Implication, left for dead. Lots of stones thrown, injured, left for dead. 3 times I was shipwrecked. 1 night and 1 day I was adrift at sea. On frequent journeys, which back in the day was a real struggle, in danger from rivers, danger from robbers, danger from my own people, danger from Gentiles, that's everyone else, danger in the city, danger in the wilderness, danger at sea, danger from false brothers, in toil and hardship, through many a sleepless night, in hunger and thirst, often without food, in cold and exposure. That's not a kind of first world problem, is it? Like, that's serious. That's not, oops, my guitar's out of tune. Like, that's serious. That's serious suffering. And so I don't want to compare sufferings with sufferings, but honestly, I think Paul's got a right to say what he wants to say about suffering, because he's gone through some stuff. He's got the scars on his back. He's felt the bruises, maybe the broken bones in his body. He's had the fear. He's had the cold. I mean, he's gone through incredible things. And so what is it that allows Paul to say these are light and momentary afflictions? Is it that he's grown really hard and cold and just is dismissive of everybody else because he's Mr. Tough? No, not at all. Instead, what we need to see is going on here is he's doing a comparison. It's like there's a massive scale, set of scales. You know what scales are? Like a seesaw, maybe a more enjoyable concept. You know, and on one side of the seesaw, this, you know, long thing, on this side is all the struggles that we have. Physical struggles, relational struggles, financial struggles, struggles with doubt, struggles with temptation, struggles with failure, struggles with all, you know, the different things that weigh us down. All of that is on one side. And it's not that he's saying it's nothing, it's that he's saying, look on the other side. Go past the tipping point, past the point that kind of forms the hinge of the seesaw, and look what's pressing down over there. It's not that this is nothing, it's that that is massive. What does he call that? He calls it the eternal weight of glory. The eternal weight of glory. He's talked about glory already. Two weeks ago we saw verse 4, he talks about the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Verse 6, he talks about the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. We could go, and it would be really helpful to go to John 17, a place where Jesus is praying to the Father, and he's talking to the Father about the glory that they had together. And you know how he describes it? It's love. The Father loving the Son, and the Son loving the Father. Jesus revealing the Father to us. It's all this relational love-giving, glorifying reality. And Paul's looking beyond this life and he's saying, as tough as this is, what's to come is so much better. When we get there, When we get to be with Jesus, when we get to look on his face and see the look of love in his eyes, when we feel his embrace and he tells us how much the Father loves us, when we are embraced by God, when we are in that world of love, as one person once put it, when we're there, we're going to realize, whoa, this is amazing. Like the weight of this, the overwhelming sense of this means that that, back here, that was nothing. I don't think we're going to forget it all. C.S. Lewis, you remember C.S. Lewis wrote Narnia and other things. He once described it this way. He said, imagine yourself a seed. You're a seed in the soil, in the ground, and you're waiting. And one day, in the gardener's good time, you're going to come out into the real world. He called it the real waking. He's talking about that future when we step into the next life that God has prepared for us if we're his. He said that's going to be like the real waking, and we're going to look back and this life is going to seem like just some sort of misty half waking. Isn't that cool? Feels so real now because it's all we can see. Feels so real now because it's what we feel. But this is light compared to that. This is momentary compared to forever. And so with these scales in mind, weighing up the tough realities of this life that Paul knew all too well with what is to come, Paul said, simple. These are light and momentary in comparison to the eternal weight of glory that is to come. And then he goes into the second paragraph. And the second paragraph follows on from this one. Okay, so the first paragraph he's saying it's better. That is better than this. Better just seems so weak. Like, big better, right? Lots better. Massive mammoth better than this in comparison. And then he carries on at the start of chapter 5, and he uses the analogy of camping. Now, I recognize that if there's ever a subject that could divide us at Trinity, it's camping. There are some people in this church who can think of nothing better than getting out a tent in a nice field somewhere, spending the night lying on various, you know, grass and stones and stuff, and just absolutely loving the whole kind of gently warm beams experience, right? I know some of you are there. I'm thinking of people, but I'm not going to name them. I know you are there. And yet at the same time, there's others in this church who would rather not ever try to sleep in a tent again. And I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to tell you who I'm thinking about or which building society he works for. But there are some people who literally think camping's the worst thing. Isn't that right? And I'm with you, brother. Right? So there's this kind of tension in camping. Now, we're living in the 21st century where, you know, it's relatively nice. We tend to think of camping as a holiday thing. For Paul, camping was a necessity, maybe for soldiers who needed somewhere to spend the night, as opposed to being exposed to the elements. So it's better to be under canvas and then pack up the tent and keep going. And so he uses the analogy of a tent. And he's talking about these jars of clay, these bodies that we're in. And he says these are like tents, right? Temporary. And frankly, not very sturdy. So he says, for we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we grow. Now that's not talking so much of camping, although I agree, I often groan. We wake up and, you know, your sleeping bag is wet. We're like, oh, that's my normal first noise when camping. But he's talking about the body, right? He's saying, in this body we grow, we're struggling. Right? It hurts, it feels weak, it's cracked, the jar of clay is not very good, the tent's a bit flappy. He says, look, we groan, we long to put on our heavenly dwelling. This is temporary, but there is a building to come, there is a permanent. There's nothing permanent about camping. Although, if you live in Chippenham, I will say this, that there is a permanent closing down sale at the camping shop just down the road. That's the closest thing I've come to anything eternal in Chippenham. It's like 10 and a half years closing down sale. incredible. But that's beside the point. Camping is supposed to be temporary, right? And even the most ardent camper amongst us eventually gets to a point where you go, I kind of want to be indoors. Kind of start to want your own bed and a warm shower and all that stuff, right? And Paul's saying, yeah, in this tent, in this body, there's a longing in us for the permanent that God has for us. Verse 3 is a little bit strange. Let me read it and then try to explain it very quickly for us. He says, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. Now, what's he talking about? I think, and you can look this up and try to figure this out as well, but I think my best assumption here is he's talking about leaving behind this jar of clay to go to the permanent abode and permanent body that is to come. I think what he's saying here is we are groaning in this jar of clay, longing to be in the permanent. We're groaning in this tent, wanting the building that God is preparing for those who are his, presuming that if we shed this tent, that hope is ours. If we're a jar of clay but we don't have the life of God within us, if we've resisted and refused and kept him at arm's length, break down the jar of clay and there is nothing in terms of that spiritual future for him to build with. There's no body to come in the positive sense that he's talking about here. So I think that's what he means. That yeah, we long to be gone from here to go there, presuming that's where we're going. Because it's not true for everyone. For some, this is all the life they'll ever taste. He's offering that life, but it's not automatically forced upon us. It's offered. I think that's probably what he's talking about here. Being found naked, as in there's nothing there. I'm done. I'm finished. Okay. Verse 4. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. Not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. It's not that we don't like the tent we're in and wish we could sleep under the stars. That's not what he's saying at all. He's saying, it's not that we don't like the tent, we want to get rid of it. We're thankful for it, but we want the permanent building that God has for us. Because it's better again. Right? And so we're living in this, anticipating that. That which is so much better than this is what we anticipate now. And so verse 5, he says, he who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us a guarantee. So while we're here, while we're in this life, with all of its struggles and all of its difficulties, God has given us a guarantee of that life. Now I would say, Paul doesn't say this, but I would say he's also given us lots of tastes. Right? We've got tastes of the life to come. We get little glimpses. And Paul could have said that. In this life, we have tastes of what is to come. Maybe let me give you a few examples. Have you ever been somewhere where the scenery is just stunning? Maybe a sunset over the ocean or a beautiful mountain range or something that's just breathtakingly beautiful. And as you stand there or sit there and look at it, sometimes there's this moment where you just want everything to pause because like, this is breathtaking. Almost like a taste of heaven. A taste of what could be and what should be. Like, this is perfect. Or maybe you've had the joy of a child, your own, or a nephew, niece, whatever, a grandchild, and you've gone through the evening, they're fed, they're bathed, they're birthed, they're dressed, they're happy, you're holding them, and they're just looking up at you. And they smile, or they laugh, and you just melt. You ever had that? You just kind of melt on the inside? And you just want to bottle that feeling and stick it in the fridge and say, that's living. Because everything else just disappears. Or maybe they're 3 or 4. Maybe the days have been challenging. Lots of, discipline issues. But all of a sudden, without warning, they pick a flower. Or they make you a picture. Or they just squeeze you around the neck and tell you you're the greatest. And you just kind of go, oh. And it's like everything just disappears. And in that moment, you go, wow, or maybe you're sat around with friends. Remember that in the old days? You sat around with friends and just, you know, chatting away, and it's not about anything, you know, massively important, but it's just good to be there, and someone says something and you start laughing and they start laughing, and before you know it, the tears are pouring down your cheeks, your side hurts, you're laughing so hard, and you just kind of think, this must be what heaven's like. Maybe. There'll be joy, there'll be relationship, there'll be that delight, there'll be more, you know, celebration than we've ever experienced, because it will be untainted, absolutely perfect. Maybe you have a taste of heaven when you eat something really good. You know, not your normal, average, everyday food, but something that's just spectacularly good. You ever had something like that? I was over at Tim's briefly this week, and he offered me, Becky, thank you very much for that brownie. Oh, unbelievable. Tim called it tiffin, which really threw me off, but just a little piece of brownie as we were chatting there, and it's like, whoa. You get these moments, don't you, where you just think, okay, now, for a split second there, I thought I'd arrived. And that's okay. That's legitimately, God gives us those things. This world is full of little glimpses, little tastes of heaven to come. Relational tastes. Sense tastes, like, you know, tastes, and the beauty of creation tastes. All of these things are good, but Paul doesn't say in this passage God has given us a taste or a glimpse of the future. He says he's given us a guarantee. Now that sounds even better, doesn't it? What's the guarantee? Well, here's the thing. Imagine for a moment that somehow you are confined in a cell, no windows, you're not going to see any of creation, it's just the 4-6 walls, right, just floor, ceiling, four walls, and you're in there. The food is drab or awful or non-existent, no contact with humans, nothing relational, nothing culinary, nothing creation related, it's just you in this kind of horrible, damp, medieval or futuristic cell. None of those tastes apply, but you still have a guarantee of heaven if you belong to Jesus. What is the guarantee? Look again at verse 5. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. You can be chained in a cell with no food, starving to death under the worst circumstances, but if you belong to Jesus, there's one thing they cannot take away from you. And that is the Spirit of God on the inside, the treasure on the inside of the jar of clay, whispering to your soul, God loves you. He's got you. It's okay, you're going to see him soon. It's okay, he still loves you. Despite all that you've done, despite all that's gone wrong, despite all the shattered dreams, God's got this. God's holding you. God loves you. The Spirit is constantly at work inside of us, reminding us that we belong to him, if indeed we do. That's the treasure. That's the guarantee. And so that is so much better than this first paragraph. Second paragraph, in this, we have guaranteed anticipation of that. Okay, can you see how these two paragraphs are working? The balance scales thing in the first one, the tent versus the permanent home in the second. That's better. It's guaranteed. And so then the third paragraph, he says, okay, so what's the result of that? What's the benefit for us in light of those two paragraphs that we've just covered? So, he says, verse 6, we are always of good courage because there is better to come. Because we have guaranteed within us by the Spirit confirmation that that better is coming, therefore we can be of good courage. That's why Christians can be courageous under the worst of circumstances, because they have a genuine hope. That's why they can endure suffering in a way that's so different from everybody else around. We are always of good courage. He says that we know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. As long as we're here, we're not with him. Because we walk by faith and not by sight. Yes, he says, we are of good courage. We would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are home in the body or away with the Lord, we make it our aim to please him. It's all about him. It's interesting how he kind of circles around this idea of courage, courage. We've got good courage. And we live our lives for him. But notice that phrase, we walk by faith and not by sight. If you hear somebody presenting Christianity to you and it sounds more like it's by sight than by faith, then something is going wrong. If they make promises that all you've got to do is pray this prayer, say this thing, and then you'll be rich and you'll be healthy and all will be well and you'll get to see the amazing things with your own eyes and you'll live off of that, that's not Christianity. That's a corrupted version of it. No, in this life, we live by faith. Interestingly, it's only in this life that we live by faith. You ever thought about that? These few years are the only opportunity that we will ever get to trust God by faith rather than by sight. Because once this is over, if we belong to him, we will be with him forever. There'll be no opportunity to say, right, today I'm going to face something difficult, uncertain in human terms of what's going to happen, but trusting in God's word and promise. You'll never get that chance again. In eternity, we'll live by sight. We'll see him. We'll see the look on his face. We'll see the fulfillment of his promises. We'll see all the good stuff. But now we live for the unseen. Which means that we go through some really challenging times with no human level guarantee of anything. You know, you're dealing with your taxes, and you know that if you just kind of fudge the numbers a little bit, then your family will be okay and it all will be well. But if you do the right thing, you're not going to be able to pay the bills. This is the only opportunity you're ever going to get to say, Lord, I'm trusting you. Even though I don't know what's going to happen, I'm trusting you to do the right thing. This is the only time in the whole of your existence where you'll get to wake up in the middle of the night and not know for certain that things are going to be okay. And say, God, I'm just going to trust you. I'm going to trust you even if I can't get back to sleep. I'm going to trust you even if the doctor says it is cancer. I'm going to trust you even if this bad thing does happen. You see, this is a unique season in our experience of existing where we get to actually live by faith. And yet our tendency is to want to do it all by sight, isn't it? It's natural. I'd rather see the money in the bank than trust God to provide it. I'd rather look healthy in the mirror than have to face a serious illness. I'd rather everything is smooth and easy than having to face the trials of this life. And yet maybe God wants to take us through those trials so that we can live by faith. Why? Because it pleases him. That's a great discussion. You'll have a good chat with somebody this week on your, you know, 1 hour walk exercise moment. When you're chatting to somebody, why not ask them this? Why do you think faith is so pleasing to God? That's a good discussion. Why does he like faith so much? What's so pleasing about us trusting him? Well, this is the only opportunity that we get. If you're maybe wrestling with something right now, it could be moral, it could be personal, it could be big, it could be small. If there's something you're not sure about, I would say just trust him. Just go for it. You know, trusting God with, you know, you feel like you should give more, you feel like you should have that conversation, or you feel, you know, you got this kind of sense, you're not sure. Go for it. What have you got to lose? One thing you could lose is that you might die and then your opportunity's gone. You might be with Jesus if you've trusted him. You'd be with him forever, which of course is better by far, but that opportunity to trust him and to please him will have passed. So go for it. We live by faith, not by sight. Now notice verses 6, 7, 8, and 9 feel super positive, don't they? Good courage, faith, not sight. We're of good courage, and we'd rather be there, but if we're here, whatever, we're going to try to please the Lord. And then you get to verse 10, and it feels like a bit of a disappointment. for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Ooh, where did he have to go there? So that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. That's a bit of a downer to end on, isn't it? Actually, I don't think it is. There is a judgment that's coming that's described in the last book of the Bible, Revelation chapter 20, called the Great White Throne Judgment. That is an absolute downer, because that will be the judgment when the books are open, and if your name is not found in the Lamb's Book of Life, then you will be disowned and separated from God forever. That is terrifying. If you don't belong to God, it should be terrifying. But that's not this. This is all of us who are followers of Jesus standing before Jesus to have our lives evaluated. Now, you might say it doesn't sound much better, but hang in there. Stay with me. I think it is. He's not going to evaluate us based on how impressive we've been. He's already been saying we're kind of jars of clay by design. It's not like we're going to stand in front of Jesus and he's going to say, well, you're not very impressive. And then we go, yeah, sorry. And he goes, oh, that's disappointing. Like he's not evaluating our impressiveness. He's going to evaluate our motives, I think. And I think that's important, because in this life and in these struggles, there are times where with good motives we try to do the right thing, but nobody notices. You know, you prepare a kids' club lesson when kids' club returns, hopefully soon, and, you know, half the kids aren't there, and the ones that are there don't listen, and you walk out feeling totally discouraged, and nobody knows. Somebody knows. But when you wake up in the middle of the night and you're really struggling, and then you kind of come to a conclusion that you're going to trust him despite all that's going on, nobody knows they're sleeping or snoring away, but somebody knows. When you do something and it misfires, you ever done that? You try to communicate and it goes wrong. You try to do something and it kind of backfires and people get upset with you. Nobody really knows what you were trying to do, but somebody knows. And one day you're going to stand before him. And if you've trusted him with your life, and his life by the Spirit is in you, he's going to be able to evaluate perfectly. Oh, by the way, that one time when you faced that thing and you weren't sure what to do, and then you just had this glimmer of trust in me, I noticed that. Thank you. That thing you tried to do that totally backfired and fell apart and, you know, just complete chaos. I saw your heart there. And I'm glad of that. And that the things that we've done that are badly motivated and, you know, kind of evil in the ways that we are so capable of, he will evaluate those too, but he's paid the price for those. And so this is an evaluation that I think leads to reward. We can receive what is due to us. And of course, we'll take our crowns and we'll cast them before him, because he's worthy of all the praise. But what a beautiful thing that is, that no matter how tough this life gets, no matter how thankless this life feels, his thank you will make it all worth it. Nothing will be missed. And that is the entry into a future with him. I think that what Paul's describing in verse 10 is actually an encouraging thing. It's not intended to terrify. As long as we belong to Jesus, we can look forward. Even though it's going to be uncomfortable in some ways, we can still look forward, because ultimately, he's going to welcome. He's going to embrace. He's going to say, well done, good and faithful servant. Even the little faith, even the flickery faith, even the unimpressive faith, he'll have seen it all, and it all counts. And it all pleases him. And so there's the section. First paragraph, he says, comparing this to that, this is light and momentary, because that is so much better. Second paragraph, he says, okay, you're in a tent and you're longing for the permanent, the building from God. Well, there's a guarantee to keep you going in the midst of this. And the guarantee is the Spirit that he's placed within you. And so as a result of those two things, we can have good courage. We can choose to live by faith, even when we can't see where it's going. We can trust him with everything. Just making it our aim to please him, knowing that he sees it all. Nothing's going to be missed. And in the end, we'll see him and he'll welcome us. That's the glory that is before us. That's what lies ahead of us. And it's that that holds us and keeps us going when life really does get tough. When we're not talking about broken strings on a guitar, but we're talking about absolute horrific suffering, it's strong enough to hold us through that because he is strong enough to carry us through that. Let's pause and just maybe reflect on where we're at. There may be something in your life that you're just wrestling with right now. In a moment, Andy's going to come up and lead us in communion. But as he's coming, I just want us to pause and reflect. Where am I at? What am I struggling with? Where is the tension that I'm feeling? And maybe you just want to say to the Lord, Lord, please stir that hope in me afresh. Get me excited for what's still to come. And of course, if you haven't trusted Christ yet, if you're not part of his family, if you feel, you know, like there's a kind of a gaping hole on the inside, this would be a good time to really start to take that seriously. We'd love to talk to anyone who feels that, who feels like, oh my goodness, this is serious. Please talk to us afterwards. But for all of us, let's just pause right now and allow our hearts and our minds to drift forward to that day. That day that helps us to live through this day. Pause for a moment, then Andy will be at the front again.